I feel the need for a podcast exploring the films and career of Tom Cruise. Welcome to Cruise Views.
Oh, wow. That was a real roller coaster just in that one word. That was incredible.
Did you think a W could be stretched out for like three syllables?
It was quite the W, wasn't it? It was quite the W.
Hello and welcome to Cruise Views, the podcast that takes a deep dive into the life and movies of ridiculously hench Department of Transport desk clerk Tom Cruise. I'm Tom Ashford, and joining me, as always, is a man who's put a bomb in my head in case I don't say something nice about him in this intro. It's Adam Scott Glasspool.
Hi. Hello. That is an unconvincing cover, isn't it?
Yeah, just slightly.
He just works the desk. Yeah. Although, I don't know, do you have really, like, hench desk people? Maybe.
Well, I mean, yeah, plausibly. Lots of people who have office jobs do go to the gym and are quite hench.
But you said it was implausible.
Well, it's just implausible that a Department of Transport clerk who looks like Tom Cruise... I'm not sure... none of it's really plausible, let's be honest, is it?
The guy should be a model. Really?
Yeah.
It just, you know, if he wasn't a spy, but he is a spy.
I mean, all the women at his party are very much on the same page of, she's done well, hasn't she?
Yeah. It's difficult to argue.
Improbably well.
Yeah, it's difficult to argue with that assessment. Look, that's because we're talking about, what year did this come out? 2006? Bloody hell.
2006.
We're 2006 already. We're talking about 2006's Mission Impossible 3 on our weird crusade to watch all of Tom Cruise's movies
in chronological order. Cruise-aid.
Yes, excellent. Excellent. Cruise-aid. Thank you. No, that was absolutely fantastic. Well worth the interruption. How do you feel about being in 2006 already? It's only taken us like... oh, not even a year to get here, really. That's pretty good going.
No, it's surreal. It doesn't feel like we've covered that many films.
Yeah, right? He is weirdly selective, I guess. We've been looking at other actors' filmographies, just because that's something that we like to do of a weekend.
It's just a hobby.
And everybody's done hundreds and hundreds of films. Except for Tom Cruise, who's done less than 50 in sort of like his... I mean, how long has it been now? 40 years?
41 years, yeah.
Yeah, 41 years since the first movie that he was in. And he, you know, he's done just under 50 movies. Very selective. And also, I think what we've seen so far is actually, compared to a lot of actors, very little shite so far.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously... let's be honest, there has been some shite. But it's
and
not
there
like,
will be some shite as well.
Oh, there will be. There definitely will be. But yeah, I mean, a lot of actors will just have swathes of like a decade of bad films.
Yeah.
Like earlier or later in their career or whatever. But like Tom Cruise is just, you know, there's some naff ones at the beginning. There's a couple of, you know, stinkers peppered here and there. But by and large, they're pretty watchable.
Yeah. They're all pretty watchable. It's just weird how selective he is, I guess. But look, that's something we can talk about when we wrap up another decade, or indeed when we wrap up his career, because we're getting closer and closer to wrapping up his career. But let's focus on this one. Mission Impossible 3, which was released on May the 5th, 2006. Big summer movie. I went to see this at the cinema. You probably did as well.
I think I did.
I think I went all the way to Gun Wharf to see this.
I mean, we had a choice of one or two cinemas, really, didn't we, at the time? It was Southampton near Portsmouth.
It wasn't even really dictated by like what was on. It was just dictated by who was going, I think. And I think I was going with people who had something to do with Portsmouth. I don't know. I can't remember. I don't know who I saw this with, but I do remember that I went to see it. Even though at the time, not necessarily like a huge Tom Cruise fan, right? And you certainly weren't already doing a podcast on Tom Cruise, were you?
Well, I don't talk about it.
Oh, really?
The one where I was around, 17, 18, making a Tom Cruise podcast.
I mean, everybody tries a Tom Cruise podcast or two when they're 17, 18. Yeah. You know,
and you look back and you think, why did I do that?
Why did I have that kind of Tom Cruise podcast? And it's good to have a different kind of Tom Cruise podcast now that we're older. Yeah. But I wasn't a huge fan. You just go because it was a Mission Impossible movie, right? It was like one of the big movies out that summer.
Yeah, big tempo release. Yeah, like you said, it's more about who, at least at the age we were, I guess, back then, it was about who you went with. Same reason, I don't think I went to see Last Samurai because it was a Tom Cruise movie, for example.
Or Collateral, right?
Yeah, I went to see them because they were just like, oh, that's a cool movie. It's Samurai. And what was that? It's a hit.
War of the Worlds as well. Yeah. We've these four movies in a row, we probably both went to see at the cinema not because we love Tom Cruise. Just because he was the biggest movie star at the time, and these were the biggest movies at the time.
Same reason you go and see I Am Legend and I, Robot with Will Smith.
Both Will Smith. Yes. Yeah. Excellent.
Big films. I, Robot.
I did not murder him. That's all I remember from that movie. Yeah. Is that all that happens in that movie? I did not murder him.
You have summed up the entire film in a line, yeah.
Okay, cool. Huge movie, which is why it's so interesting that they gave it to J.J. Abrams to direct. Because in 2006, is J.J. Abrams a big name?
Yes. No.
Well, he was
doing Lost, so I guess in the industry, he would have been quite a up and coming. This is a big deal on the way sort of guy.
Yes, so he did Lost. The only bits of Lost that he directed were the pilot episode, I believe, and he's a producer on the rest of it. But I believe that he's pretty hands off for a lot of Lost.
I haven't properly watched it because I remember being really pissed off at the time because of its storytelling style.
Sure.
Which at the time I sort of suspected, and then since it has come out, that literally they would have just been like, what's a cool idea? That, to stick it in somewhere and the audience will make up a really interesting fan theory.
That's my understanding of it as well. Yeah.
And they kind of pretended that wasn't the case, and now they all admit
it was the case. It was the case, wasn't
it? Shit.
And everyone pretended it was good. Everyone pretended it was good, Tom. Yep. Everyone was like, oh, Lost, you've got to watch Lost. Everyone was like, you've got to watch Lost. And I didn't watch Lost, and now everybody tells me Lost is shit. Yeah. So I feel like I haven't wasted X amount of time watching Lost, because I've heard it's a piece of shit, Tom.
It's a piece of shit. As is the mystery box style of storytelling, J.J. Abrams, who I hated for so long.
Which is kind of his one thing, really. Did he have something to do with Cloverfield? He did, right?
Yes.
Yeah, he did.
And one of the writers from Lost went on to do Prometheus and turned it from an alien film into a incomprehensible sci-fi mess that sort of just throws an alien in halfway through.
I like Prometheus.
I like Prometheus, but it is a botched attempt at an alien movie because he literally just took out the answers and went, we've got loads of questions now. That's storytelling.
Well, yeah, I suppose so. I think the thing that J.J. Abrams was most famous for, aside from Lost, was Alias, right? Did you ever watch the TV show?
No.
Did you not? It's kind of like a spy sort of thriller thing. It was kind of like The X-Files, where it was like, some episodes of it were episodic and some of it were like part of this larger sort of mythology thing that was going on. And it was Jennifer Garner. That was also Jennifer Garner's sort of like rise to prominence. And Mission Impossible 3 is the first movie that J.J. Abrams directs. And then he goes on to do Star Trek.
Yep.
And then he does Super 8.
Yep,
and then he does Star Trek Into Darkness.
Not as good.
And then he ruins Star Wars.
Twice.
Imagine ruining it twice.
I don't even hate them, but I mean, he did a remake of an old Star Wars film and then did a pretty bad Star Wars film.
He ruined it. And then he took what he had and ruined that. Yeah. It's an absolutely incredible run and of in ruining when, things given to him.
Guys, a random other guy that isn't me ruined the Star Wars films.
No, that's the best
one. I'll ruin it more.
That's the best one of the three by a little distance. Yeah, J.J. Abrams, he kind of has a distinctive style, right? I mean, there is the story box
lens
telling
flare.
The stuff that he produces. Yes, and obviously just sort of like lens flare. And it's sort of like... you know, we can compare this to last week. It's kind of Spielberg light in many ways. You know, Super 8 is a very Spielberg-esque sort of thing. I'm very surprised that he's not a producer on Stranger Things. That seems weird to me because it really seems like he should be. But he is a producer on every Mission Impossible movie from this point onwards,
even the new ones. I didn't realize that.
And all the way up until Dead Reckoning part one and part two, he has a little sort of piece of those. He is kind of more of a producer than he is a director, which is probably a good thing. I think he needs someone to come in and help him hold his hand a little bit, make sure he's doing a good job.
Good job, JJ.
And to help him on this one, because he did actually have a hand in writing the screenplay, but he writes it with people that he writes with a lot, right? Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orci, who are kind of blockbuster writers. They wrote Legend of Zorro, they wrote Transformers, Star Trek, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. So, you know, it is kind of hit and miss their career. But Kurtzman and Orci, they kind of always write together, and they often write with J.J. Abrams. And it's starring Tom Cruise.
Yep.
Yeah? Okay.
Picked up on that.
Good. He's in
It'd be weird
scene.
If he wasn't in it, let's be honest.
It would.
Mission Impossible, well, almost a Mission Impossible 5, I guess. We'll get to that.
Well, yeah. Well, it's 4 where they try and... 4 is the beginning of that, isn't it? Where they try and sort of like elbow him out. And then we have Christopher McQuarrie to thank because he came in, looked at the script and went, no. Anyway, it also stars Michelle Monaghan. Now, I recognise Michelle Monaghan and I've seen her in things like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And I've seen her in some of the other Mission Impossible movies.
I was going to say, I recognise her from small parts in Mission Impossible.
Mm.
Later on.
I think she's in Ghost Protocol very, 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 very briefly.
And in Fallout.
Yeah, and
slightly
in Fallout.
Longer.
She's in Fallout a little bit more. But apart from that, she just kind of crops up here and there. I don't think she's ever really... led her own movie, but she's always good. She's in Mr. and Mrs. Smith. She's in Gone Baby Gone just after Mission Impossible 3. She's in Maid of Honor, a title that I cannot stand. Eagle Eye, that's something she was in. Is that the Shia LaBeouf? Yeah, Shia LaBeouf. No, not Helen Mirren. Yes, Helen Mirren. No, you're thinking of
Eye
War.
Of the Sky.
You're thinking of Pie in the Sky or whatever
Pie
it is
in the
that
sky.
You said.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is like a techno thriller from 2000 and something.
It sounds worse.
2008. Yeah, she plays opposite Shia LaBeouf. Shia LaBeouf, interesting guy. Do you like Shia LaBeouf?
No. I mean, I don't care. He's one of those people that crops up in the news so often, and I'm just like, I don't give a shit. It's Shia LaBeouf. He's just a human being that exists.
Right. He's a pretty interesting artist.
Yeah.
But he doesn't seem like a cool guy. Let's put that way.
He strikes me as the sort of artist that is all like, oh, I've got to be a dickhead because of the art.
Yeah, I mean...
And he's also not quite good enough to really justify it.
I think he does have some good performances.
I don't think he's bad.
His treatment of FKA Twigs was obviously like really horrible. And the weird thing, Honey Boy is a movie where he played his own dad. and was like showing how abusive his dad was, and on the press tour was like, yeah, it was difficult to play my own dad, especially with how abusive he was, and you can see in the film how abusive he was, and then recently said, oh, I made that up.
Oh, good.
Turns out his dad was fine. That's a weird thing to do, isn't it?
I'm sure his dad really appreciated that as well. I was like, oh,
yeah,
thanks, son.
Weird. Fucking weird.
I spent 18 years of my life raising you well.
Yeah, insane.
And then you call me an abuser.
I wonder if,
money.
You know, something just snaps in the heads of performers or entertainers who are in the industry from a very, very young age. Because he's a child star, basically, right? I remember him from Even Stevens. Tom Cruise, Michelle Monaghan, Philip Seymour Hoffman. I love Philip Seymour Hoffman. What a pleasure.
He's great.
So good in this movie. We've seen him before on this series, Tom.
Yes, Magnolia.
Yeah, Magnolia. He works with Paul Thomas Anderson a lot. One of his first major roles was in Hard Eight, which is Paul Thomas Anderson's first film. Then he's in Twister, an absolute classic. And then obviously there's Boogie Nights. And he's in The Big Lebowski. He takes all these sort of like small roles. And then it's around sort of like... I mean, it's not until a bit later in his career that he starts getting much, much bigger roles. Mission Impossible 3 probably helps with that. And then he does stuff like Synecdoche, New York, which is just, like, incredible. And he's in things like Moneyball. And obviously he's in The Master. And then he's in the two final parts of the Hunger Games movie. And then, of course, very sadly, he killed himself, didn't he? Yeah, really sad, really sad. Incredible actor. Definitely, I think, goes some way to kind of elevating this movie a little bit.
Yeah, and I think there's a few characters in this which become a little bit caricatured.
Mm.
And he feels like much more of a real human being.
He does, yeah. And he feels genuinely... dangerous, and he feels he's very watchable in it as well. I mean, my big take on this movie, right, is that it's not terribly interesting. We made a joke last week about how Steven Spielberg is the world's most competent director, right? Obviously, Spielberg's an amazing director. J.J. Abrams, I would describe as a competent director.
Yes.
Like, he is getting through here and he's absolutely fine.
He's the new Ron Howard.
He's the new Ron Howard. There's absolutely nothing remarkable about this movie except for, I would say, Tom Cruise's performance, because this is kind of the birth of what we understand Tom Cruise to be now. And Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance and the way that those two performances play off one another. And then it's also got Ving Rhames in it, who's
always
back
a
again.
Pleasure.
And I forgot that, because I thought it was the next one was his first appearance, Simon Pegg's in this.
Yeah.
Simon Pegg is, I remember at the time thinking like, oh, it's weird that this British guy from a sitcom and that one British movie that just happened to be quite successful, it's weird that he's in Mission Impossible 3.
Yeah, because I think Hot Fuzz had come out at this point.
No, maybe this is pre-Hot Fuzz by a whole year.
Wow. Okay, yeah, so at the time, I only knew him from Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, that's how anybody knew him. He was in Spaced, Shaun of the Dead, and he'd done bits and pieces in, you know, Black Books and Look Around You and Doctor Who. And he was kind of briefly in the League of Gentlemen movie. And then he's in Mission Impossible 3.
Yeah.
Stood next to Tom Cruise.
And obviously at this point, it's very much like a comedy, keep him out of the action, just cut to him, have him say some funny lines, small part essentially. And then it's just obviously ballooned since to being like, oh, you're a core member of the IMF team now.
Yeah, it is remarkable.
And you're Simon Pegg.
It's remarkable how important he is to the Mission Impossible franchise, that they keep bringing him back and giving him integral roles when it started as like this little, what, he probably doesn't even have 5 minutes of screen time, right? It's kind of like, and it's a bit like comic relief and all, this fussy British guy. And it's just weird also to think that, you know, in his personal life, he's just friends with Tom Cruise. Because he does just kind of feel like a British nerd that likes Star Wars and stuff, right? But now he's friends with Tom Cruise and they go on activities together. But it does mean that there is hope for us, though. It does mean that there's hope for us. We can become friends with Tom Cruise if we really put our mind to it.
Also, I've just realised that obviously it kind of makes sense to be like, oh, well, in future Mission Impossible films, we're going to need like some guy who's really good at tech because we're going to need more and more advanced tech stuff. But the last two films have exclusively involved Ving Rhames because he's good at tech. He's the cool guy.
Before, it used to be that they needed a helicopter pilot. 100% could not do without a helicopter pilot. I believe they get a helicopter pilot in this one, don't they?
Of course, yeah.
Is his name Jonathan Rhys-Meyers? Yeah, he's the helicopter pilot.
The man with the most chiselled face in history.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good-looking guy. That's a good-looking guy. It's weird that his career didn't take off in some kind of way. See, like, of the two British actors in this, Simon Pegg and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, was not expecting Simon Pegg to be the one that maintains his place in the franchise, you know?
No.
But
do they just give up on helicopter pilots? Are they just like, guys, we've got so many transport options now, we don't need a helicopter pilot.
But we do need two tech guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what they land on. So who flies all the helicopters in the subsequent movies? Because there are helicopters. Oh, well, Tom Cruise does, doesn't he? Of course, I forgot. Of course he does. He's slowly chiselling away at the team so that he just ends up doing everything like a Swiss Army man. The movie, obviously produced by Tom Cruise, also, this is, you know, the Mission Impossible franchise is his baby. It had a bit of a weird production history. It was supposed to come out in like 2004, and it was supposed to be directed by David Fincher.
What?
That's who was supposed to direct Mission Impossible 3, and it got really, really close. Like, they were...
Imagine how dark that film would be.
Right, or imagine David Fincher's career post Mission Impossible 3. Like, That would have been very, very interesting. What had he done at this point? He hadn't hit Zodiac, right? No, he hadn't hit Zodiac. He must have left this to go and do Zodiac, basically, because Zodiac comes out the year after this. That's a good decision for David Fincher. Zodiac is fantastic. But he had just done Panic Room, having done Fight Club before that, and The Game before that. So it kind of makes sense that he's on that trajectory of thrillers that are getting kind of bigger and bigger in scope. If he did a dark
Mission Impossible film, that would fit.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so it's not David Fincher, obviously. He leaves due to sort of like creative differences, right? And so it gets handed to Joe Carnahan instead. Now, do you know anything about Joe Carnahan? There's no real reason you should.
No, I mean, the name doesn't ring a bell, so I'm going to presume no.
So he directed Narc, okay? Now, that's kind of like a dark early 2000s thriller. And then he directed, well, instead of this, he directed Smoking Aces. Have you seen that?
I think I might have.
Yeah, I think I had that on DVD at some point because I bought it for like a fiver from Tesco one evening. And then he went on to direct The A-Team and The Grey. The movie where Liam Neeson fights a pack of wolves.
Which I have seen.
I've seen that. Did we watch it at the same time?
I think we might have.
Did we watch it
around
house?
Pete Williams' house?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. The Grey.
The Grey.
The wolves don't care about you. Anyway, so it gets handed off to him. And then he also leaves, citing creative differences. And I think Joe Carnahan, pretty weak director, if I'm honest, does not really have a visual style and probably did not like being bossed around by Tom Cruise, who I think we've come to learn is quite bossy.
Yeah, right? That is a trait that has emerged.
Yeah, and David Fincher, a man with a very secure in his visual style and insane amounts of control David Fincher has on his movies, yeah. Right? Like, just watch any of the making ofs of any of his movies. Social Network's a good one. The guy has an insane control on what he wants on the screen. He'll do things like 100 takes of the same scene. He will do like numerous takes. I remember an interview with Jake Gyllenhaal where he was saying he was just getting so frustrated because he wanted like over 40 takes of him just throwing a file onto a car seat and it had to fall in exactly the right way. And he was just getting him to do it again and again and again. The best thing I can think of to describe how detailed a director David Fincher is, right, is that when they were making Zodiac, his research into the actual case was so thorough that it gave the investigators leads that they didn't have before the making of the movie.
Right.
So that's how like detailed and in control David Fincher is. Probably not a good match for Tom Cruise's producing style, I reckon.
No.
Which is a shame.
As much as I would love to see the film of David Fincher and Tom Cruise.
Well, I actually think that like visually, the latest Mission Impossible movies, like probably Fallout and Rogue Nation, Fallout mostly, give you a really good idea of what a David Fincher Mission Impossible movie would be like visually. There's a lot of David Fincher in those visuals, I think. It's unfortunate he left because he also took Kenneth Branagh and Carrie-Anne Moss with him, who were right. cast members yeah. who just had to leave because it just kept getting rescheduled and rescheduled and rescheduled. And then Cruise brings on JJ because he binged the first two seasons of Alias and was like, this is the mood. Let's bring on JJ Abrams to direct Mission Impossible 3. And from what I can work out, he does direct Mission Impossible 3.
As far as my research has gone, that is what yeah. I've concluded. Yeah.
I have been led to believe that JJ Abrams directed Mission Impossible 3. From everything I've read about it, he's the director.
Good.
But I don't know. It looks like nobody directed this movie in some ways. Do you know, it's like such yeah. such a normal movie.
Adam, sometimes there's a filter put over the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it feels like everything's really green.
Right. Yeah. Or really blue and in some places.
Or really blue in some, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Literally if it's in a different place.
There's and some lens flare as well.
Oh, of course there's lens flare. I mean, yeah. that is directing 101.
In it.
We're in an Asian place. Put a yellowy-green filter over it. We're in yeah. a more technologically advanced Asian place. Put a blue filter over it.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. It's like those films where you're like, oh, well, we must be in Mexico because they've put an orange yeah. filter over the lens.
The classic Breaking Bad. We're in New right, Mexico, yeah. therefore it looks normal. We've crossed the border. It's now all sepia.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, cool. The same desert. But it's fine.
The interesting thing is this movie, Mission Impossible 3, a movie which, incidentally, right, I like, okay? I like this movie. But I generally think it's just sort of fine. But it does feel tonally and visually distinct from the two that came before it, right?
Yeah, which yeah. I think at this stage is quite good because it kind of gives each film its own distinct vibe. And I think that the first film is a really nice standalone tight thriller.
Yeah.
That you wouldn't really be able to carry on, I don't think. The second one is Mission Impossible 2. And you certainly don't want to carry on with that.
The second one is indeed Mission Impossible 2. Yeah, yeah. With its very own, you know, distinct style as well.
Yeah. And 3 feels different in a way that they could and did continue with and evolve.
Yeah, kind of. Like, the thing is, like, this one feels different because the first two are so distinct. Like, Mission Impossible 2 is very much early 2000s American cinema meets Hong Kong kind of influences, right? And then the first one is like, well, it's basically a Hitchcock film, like we said on the episode, with all these like mad angles and everything. And then the thing that makes this one different from those two is that this is more normal.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, there's an argument to be said that that's less interesting. That's a bit disappointing.
It is, but luckily it's better than two.
It is better than two, yeah.
And so that forgives everything.
That's true.
It's not as good as one, as one, but it is better than two. So
yes, that's true. Tandiwe Newton was offered to come back. Like, they said, do you want to come back for a third one? And she went, no, I don't think I will, actually. I think I'm all right then.
I really want her to come back in Dead Reckoning Part 1 or 2.
Oh, imagine if they bring back Naya. That would be an insane twist.
Considering how, like, confident an actress Tandiwe Newton is now.
Yeah.
She would play such a badass just storming in.
Well, it's not outside of the... They're bringing back a character from Mission Impossible 1.
Yeah.
They're bringing back Kittredge. It's not outside of the realms of possibility. I wonder if it's occurred to them. I wonder if they've tried to bring back Dougray Scott's character. Oh, wouldn't that be good? We'd all love to see that. We'd love to see Dougray Scott be the villain in the new Mission Impossible movies, wouldn't we?
I'm glad he's dead.
Okay.
The character, I don't know if the actual actor is alive or not. And if he isn't, I'm very sorry. Because I'm sure he's lovely.
Hope nothing horrible happens to Dougray Scott in between us recording this and it coming out. That would be,
But the character, Trevelyan, glad he's dead.
That character, he's so Trevelyan.
Let's
talk about the actual film, which opens with Ethan Hunt, who's played by Tom Cruise. He's the leader of the Impossible Mission Force. I hate that they undercut that in this movie. Just have some bloody respect. Anyway.
Because you have to think that there's literally a government or non-government agency that is called the Impossible Mission Force. And nobody has thought, let's rebrand this. At any point, no one has gone, we have to change this just to literally be like Special Intelligence or something.
No,
anything.
Great. I love it. I love it.
I like that. So if they haven't done that, no other characters allowed to mention it.
Right, exactly.
The whole universe has to think that's okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, I agree. Yeah. But anyway, he's been, like, kidnapped, hasn't he? He's tied to a fucking chair or something. And do you know what? It was actually weird watching this after a while of not having seen it. Because obviously I know that the woman that's tied up opposite him is his wife. Except you don't know that at this point in the movie. It's just some woman who has a gun to her head. And it's being held by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And again, we don't know anything about these people. He wants the rabbit's foot, Tom. Which is a very frustrating plot point in a Mission Impossible movie. Because I want intrigue and, you know, spy shit. I like the nitty-gritty of... you know, well, this person has this thing that unlocks this thing, and that's because of his relationship with this person or whatever. But this movie is just like, there's something called the rabbit's foot. You never find out what it is, and that's what all the characters are after.
And you know why that is, Adam? Because the fucking mystery box.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I don't
Where's
even...
the rabbit's foot? We're not telling you what it is. Make that up yourself. It's better than what we'll write.
It's not very intriguing, it turns out. But he wants the rabbit's foot, or he's going to kill this woman. And he counts down from 10, and it gets more and more serious. And it's probably Tom Cruise's strongest bit of acting in this movie as well. So it's good that they opened with it. He genuinely looks deranged, like beyond deranged in this section of the movie.
And Hoffman is so menacing in a way that we haven't seen anyone be menacing in this and in this series.
He's in control. Ethan Hunt is usually the one in control. And this is the first time, I think, that we see the Ethan who is having to play it as it lies. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Hoffman is so like, he's so calm and measured. So there's, you don't have any doubt that he will just shoot this person in the head. Whereas yeah. normally in these sort of films, you're like, he won't shoot her in the head.
Right, exactly.
He's a villain, but he's not that much of a villain.
And this then he time counts he like, down from yeah. 10. And what does he do then?
He just pulls the trigger.
He shoots her in the head. Yeah. And yeah. the shot goes into the title sequence. The title sequence is better than Mission Impossible 2. It's not as good as Mission Impossible 1. Because the music just it's not right. It's just not right. I don't know what it is about it, but it's just not right. They've added like some military drum stuff in there. It's just not right.
Yeah. I don't really recall it, but I do recall thinking it was a bit tinny.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
that's it. It's just a little bit like... It's just not quite... hasn't got the weight behind it.
Not enough heft yeah. to it. It needs to be a hefty theme tune. And then we're into the actual movie. Like, all of that little intro, it's kind of separate. It'll come back later. So, at the moment, as we are in Mission Impossible 3, Ethan Hunt, who's played by Tom Cruise...
Yep.
Has retired from being an IMF team leader, okay? And is instead kind of living the quiet life with his fiancée, Julia, and that's the woman from the beginning. She's yep. played by Michelle Monaghan. And she's a hospital nurse, and we see them during their engagement party, and it's much more of a peek into Ethan's private life than we've had before. And that we even ever have since, I think. He's kind of, in the most recent ones, he's permanently on mission rather than yeah. having any downtime, right?
It's a little bit uncomfortable watching it.
It is.
Because it's just like, this isn't real. This is like so make-believe. He's just sort of like, oh, I'm happy. I'm going to, you know,
yeah,
get the beers out. And it's
also
it's
quite
wrong.
A good Tom Cruise performance.
Yeah.
Because he's playing like a happy, relaxed person, which we haven't seen him play in so long.
It's basically, he's playing Jerry Maguire.
Yeah, kind of.
Because he's like, hey!
And he's got the big
happy Jerry Maguire
grin.
At the end of Jerry Maguire.
Yeah, exactly. And he does that thing with the lip reading. I love that yeah. bit with the lip reading, because when he tells him what lake it was, because he's such a dork and he's just like happy to be there. He's just a real geek. And everyone finds him boring because he's talking about traffic stuff, right?
Well, that's the thing. He's talking to like a mixed gender group about like, yeah, his boring traffic stuff. And then as he leaves, the guy's just like, oh, Jesus. Like, rolls his eyes, and all the women are like, yeah.
Ooh. Ooh. I think one of them says, like, I'd marry him. And then
yeah.
another equally alarming thing in this scene is that Aaron Paul is in it.
Yeah, that threw me right out. I was like, right, this is ruined forever. I can't watch this as anything other than Jesse Pinkman turns up.
Yeah, bizarre, isn't it? Really weird, really, really weird. But then something happens halfway through the party, Tom, because Ethan is contacted by IMF Operations Director Musgrave, who's played by Billy Crudup, and they have to like meet at a 7-Eleven, I think it is, and they have like a spy conversation, don't they? And it's all very shiny. J.J. Abrams loves shiny fluorescent lights and lens flare and stuff, and he's trying to convince him that, you know, he needs to get back into the field for this one last job. You know, just when he thought he was out, they pull him
back
in.
so haven't seen the film, but I have seen Sopranos.
Okay, I haven't seen Sopranos. I have seen the GIF. and I can only imagine that that's what Al Pacino's voice does in that movie.
God's sake.
he gives him a disposable camera. It's really fascinating to trace the delivery of the message through Mission Impossible movies in time, because what was the first one? How does he gets it as a tape on a cassette tape to watch a movie on an airplane, right?
Yeah.
Yep. In the second one, it's sunglasses that explode.
After being fired at him in a rocket from a helicopter. They could drop it out the helicopter. They could fly overhead and just hand it to him. That would have cost so much money, Adam, creating a non-reusable rocket.
Well, this one is a disposable camera.
Yeah.
And he goes home and he views the video that's hidden in the camera, and he finds out that he is basically wanted. His mission, should he choose to accept it. And in this case, I think it is should he choose to accept it, right? It's not a foregone conclusion. They want him to rescue an agent, Lindsay Farris, who is Ethan's protege and has been captured in Berlin by Owen Davian. And Owen Davian is of course, Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. He is a prominent dealer in the international black market. Because it's his protege, Ethan, played by Tom Cruise, he's like, okay, fine, I will do this. And he meets the team that has been pre-selected for him, which includes Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, Maggie Q, who I know very little about, except she was in Die Hard 4, right? Around probably the same time, whenever Die Hard 4 was. And, of course, Luther's there, Ving Rhames, Big
also
Luther.
Also Luther is there.
Yeah, he just fantastic.
Just doesn't matter what skill set's required, he'll be there doing something irrelevant to his previous experience.
He was up for it. They put the word out. Luther was the first to put his hand up. Bless him.
How is he going to afford those like expensive shoes and briefcases?
Well, that's true. Exactly. He ruined his last pair by standing in poo in Australia. And they don't really hang around, you know, in previous ones for any kind of section of the Mission Impossible movies where they've needed to go and achieve something, you'll see them plan it out and discuss what's going on, or at least there'll be some kind of team bonding. But no, we're straight into the team assaulting the enemy stronghold in Berlin. And there's like a big shootout, right?
Yeah, and it's very quick and very sudden, and as much as I enjoyed it, it feels very out of place for a Mission Impossible movie.
Yeah, especially
it's much better than the shootouts in 2, just to be clear.
But then also, this is the thing though, right, Tom? Yeah, I do think it's better than the shootouts in Mission Impossible 2. It's less distinct than the shootouts in Mission Impossible 2. This just looks like any action movie from around this time. It looks a bit like the Bourne movies, I suppose.
Yeah, but then to a degree I think it's better because Ethan Hunt would have had weapons training, obviously, even though he doesn't use a gun in the first film.
Sure.
But you can believe he has had weapons training. It'd be weird to not. And so him being in almost like a military strategy sort of infiltrate, in, out, done, makes so much more sense, even if he's firing an automatic weapon, than diving through the air with two automatic pistols with doves flying behind him.
Disagree.
With sunglasses.
Disagree. Disagree. Yeah, but I don't go to the Mission Impossible movies for gritty realism.
I think that's the reason why you don't get that sort of shootout really going forwards in the Mission Impossible series, is because Ethan Hunt firing an automatic weapon in anything other than just trying to escape,
it's pretty boring really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not as interesting as the stuff that Ethan Hunt is known to do, which is the death-defying stunts in order to infiltrate something without anyone knowing.
Yeah, and they have that in this movie, and it's not that good.
No.
It's like the weakest one and so far. Anyway.
I don't want to harp on about it, Adam, but
yeah, go on.
There was another chance for a base jump. Didn't fucking take it, did he?
It didn't take it. No. You'll be very disappointed to find out it was all done on a green screen as well.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I had a look just to double check to see, did he do anything? Did he jump off the building? No, he didn't even jump off the building.
Well, we're not in full Madman Cruise yet. This is the beginning of some stuff, isn't it? He has done his own stunts before, but nothing truly ludicrous, you know? Yeah.
And he is doing all the stuff in green screen, some of which is still impressive in the sense that, like,
oh yeah,
I know that the running off the rooftop bit, he literally runs off a very tall structure with green screen and just jumps off it. So he does the equivalent thing. He just doesn't, you know, do the obviously CGI parachute bits.
Yes, obviously.
Yeah.
They do extract Agent Farris successfully. And there's a bit of a helicopter chase through a wind farm while they try and... What is it that they're trying to do? They're trying to defuse something that's in her head, right?
Yes, so she's got like a chip that will set off a bomb, or you know, it's a tiny little bomb in her brain.
It's going to blow up her brain.
It's going to blow up her brain juices, yeah. And they need to like basically fry it using the defibrillator stuff. Yeah.
I call it defrib because I did a first aid course today, so
yeah,
I just know the lingo. Defrib. Yeah.
Because professionals don't use the full word.
No.
So yeah, they need to do that to basically short circuit the bomb so that it can't go off.
Which they don't end up successfully doing. Her brain explodes.
Which even if you know it's coming, as both of us would have, it still takes you by surprise.
Yeah, it does. Because one of her eyes just deviates.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, okay, oh, God.
It's the most gruesome thing since the guy who got his head impaled in the lift. In Mission Impossible 1.
Oh, R.I.P. Emilio Estevez. Who, again, in real life, is not dead.
Not dead.
There's a funeral scene, and just after the funeral, Ethan is notified that a package had been sent to him by Lindsay, the agent that has just died, and then finds out that it's a micro dot hidden under the stamp of a blank postcard. And they kind of discuss the possible importance of that micro dot with Luther, and they both kind of decide to keep its existence a secret. I assume that they think, oh, well, this could go all the way to the top. And it's all fine. It's indistinct. It doesn't have the style of the previous two, but that's, you know, I guess a little bit in the same way that these first three I see as a little like microcosm, in the same way that the whole series of James Bond kind of gives you a good idea of what was popular at the time each movie was made.
Yes.
Even though, like, obviously the James Bond series is much better at showing you what was popular at the time. Like, like, you know, blaxploitation movies became a big deal in, like, 70s cinema, so they made Live and Let Die. Then Star Wars was a big success, so they made Moonraker. And then, you know, once the Bourne movies come out, they make the Daniel Craig movies, which are much more like down to earth. And it's an interesting series. But the first three are kind of like that. There's a 90s one, an early 2000s one, and a mid 2000s one. And this one's just very mid 2000s, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah. It's kind of, it's interesting that we're talking about the similarities in some way between J.J. Abrams and Spielberg.
Mm.
Because there's an element of, like, having watched War of the Worlds where some of it kind of feels similar in the way it's done. I'm thinking stuff like the bridge sequence.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a Spielbergian action sequence feel to that, to some degrees.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. I mean, J.J. Abrams loves Spielberg. I don't know what to tell you. It's just, and if you're going to rip
Super
someone
8 should
off,
be a Spielberg film.
It's, right, it's, yeah,
the,
exactly.
It's the bridge between E.T. and Cloverfield.
Yeah, I can see that. Absolutely, definitely. And if you're going to rip someone off, rip off Steven Spielberg. That's kind of what, I mean, look, it's a drastic reduction of how good I think the movie is, but Jordan Peele just kind of took a lot of Spielberg's playbook for Nope, and I think it works really well there, because if you're going to rip off someone, rip off Steven Spielberg.
And most people won't notice, because everyone overlooks Spielberg.
Yeah, exactly. We can't spend another episode talking about how overlooked Steven Spielberg is.
I don't
is.
Think Spielberg has been covered enough in this podcast. Every time, even the slightest cameo, we're like, oh, let's talk about Spielberg for a moment. I think we should do this with every film, including the ones that have nothing to do with Spielberg like this.
Okay, I promise. I'll bring up Spielberg every fucking week. They use information recovered from a laptop in the Berlin mission, which is where Simon Pegg comes in and kind of goes some way to explaining what the rabbit's foot might be, which is just some kind of world-ending technology, right?
Yeah, he's got a great line that I had to note down, which is, this one's got a hole in it, I can't even look at it. Which, delivered by Simon Pegg, is just so
he's funny.
Flippant.
He's good.
It's such a nice little change for Mission Impossible.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, to have that sort of like very obvious. Because, I mean, who was the comic relief in the previous ones? I mean, Mission Impossible 2 had no comic relief whatsoever.
I was going to say, I couldn't remember Dougray Scott.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, Mission Impossible 1. No, nothing.
The comic relief in number 2 would have been the Australian helicopter pilot.
Of course it was. How silly of me to have forgotten.
He's Australian. He's going to
whatever
be the comic
his name is.
Yeah.
So then Ethan played by Tom Cruise, then decides to go after Davian himself and discovers that he'll be at the Vatican City, where a lucrative transaction will take place involving this mysterious object, codenamed the Rabbit's Foot. This is after a very, like, brisk meeting with the director of the IMF, played by Lawrence Fishburne, who is really giving it the full, like, police chief from a Lethal Weapon sort of movie, yeah. Right? He's saying things like, don't interrupt me when I'm asking rhetorical questions, and all of like all of that really quippy stuff like that.
Which is awful, but also because it's Lawrence Fishburne, fine.
Yeah, he gets away with it. It's bad writing and a good delivery of it, I think, is Lawrence Fishburne's character. But they're using a lot of shoe leather here to make sure that we think he's the villain when the ultimate sort of twist sort of comes.
Do you know what I noticed, Adam? And I think you'll appreciate this, because normally I wouldn't notice this.
Yeah.
But whenever the camera was on Tom Cruise's face when they were being grilled by Lawrence Fishburne, absolutely static.
Yeah.
Every time it was on Musgrave, shaking all over the shop because he's absolutely shitting bricks.
Exactly.
And the camera stays completely static on Cruise basically the whole film up until the point where he's surrounded by people when they think he's...
And then it starts moving all over the place.
It starts wobbling all over because he just had the phone call about his wife and is like, ah!
Yeah, it's a neat little bit of direction. It's pretty standard direction.
But I noticed it, Adam, and I would not notice this.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's the evolution of me
in
this podcast.
Has doing this changed the way you watch movies at all?
To some extent, yeah.
Do you like that or not?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay. I learned how to watch movies like this, like the way that I watch movies, ruined my life. Because you can never watch it back the other way now. You can't.
Well, we both saw a film recently that I think we should discuss briefly in the next episode.
Oh, we're going to have so much space in the next episode. Don't worry about discussing it briefly, Tom. We'll
discuss it in length.
We'll discuss it at length at the expense of discussing the movie that we're here to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the sort of film that I, again, not letting anyone know what it is, I spent the whole time going, I think this is a good film. Am I enjoying it? I don't know, but I'm appreciating the way it's made.
Okay, I don't know. Like, I don't know what film you're talking about, Tom. Tom, that's how I watch all movies.
Switch my brain off.
Right, was that a new feeling for you?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, when I'm watching a film that's been deliberately set out to be, like, artful, shall we say, in a way that Mission Impossible 3 is not necessarily, then I usually sit back and I actually try to sit forward and try to watch for how the film is being constructed and stuff like that. When I'm watching a Mission Impossible movie, I want to sit back and just let it wash over me and enjoy it.
I see. What I do, and this is going to make me sound like a real pretentious wanker, right, is I try and watch all films as though they are the peak of high art. I think they all deserve exactly that same level of, like, intense, active watching and thinking about what the camera is doing, what the director is trying to do, what the style is, and all of that stuff.
I dare say that's the reason I can enjoy more recent MCU entries than you, Adam.
Oh, no, I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know.
Because I probably agree with your view that the things you're picking up, if you're watching it and being like, I'm going to really intensely, like,
stuff that I'm looking at when I'm watching films in that way is not the be-all and end-all, you know?
Right.
And when I watched Thor, Love and Thunder, for instance, an incredibly anonymous-looking movie that I don't think is well-directed. I think the pacing is so far off. I think the tone is wildly misplaced in a bunch of places. That obviously marks it down for me. And then on the flip side of that, I didn't find it entertaining either. So, I am bearing in mind how entertaining I find things.
Whereas I found it entertaining, and it's in retrospect that I can agree with everything you've said.
Yeah, absolutely. This movie that we're talking about, Mission Impossible 3, is a really good example of it. A completely anonymous movie that I don't think is up there in even the top 50% of like interesting looking movies or well directed movies or whatever. I'm going to give it 7 out of 10, Tom. It's like an enjoyable movie. It's perfectly it's entertaining.
Yeah,
it's
I had fun. A lot of fun.
Yeah, exactly. Especially in this next sequence, because this is the Vatican City sequence, and it's the closest we kind of get to a heist.
It's great. They do a great job. I genuinely think that although it's not necessarily as like neatly constructed, because it's a little almost too elaborate, constructed as the heist in the first film, it's as enjoyable because they go full into the they just lean right into the ludicrousness,
the wackiness of Mission Impossible. Plan which is a great decision. And there's also something that I think really elevates it. We should say, before he leaves, he does marry Julia in like a small ceremony at the hospital, because you know he has to keep making excuses about where he's going because she thinks he's just like a transport guy and he's going to conferences.
Going to another conference.
Tom, when you go to another authors conference, we'll leave it. All right, no, it's fine. When you're going to quote unquote Las Vegas or quote unquote Florida, anyway, look, it doesn't matter.
Don't watch the news in the next few weeks.
Okay, cool. he asks her to like trust him, and they get married as that sort of sign of trust, and it's nice. It's nice, you know. I like to see Ethan Hunt happy. He's my favorite person in the world. He's my brother.
He's Steve's brother.
Oh yeah, and his dad. I couldn't work out what was going on.
Don't
with that.
Question that any further.
We'll have to have him back at some point and figure out his family tree. Anyway, their plan is to abduct Davian, right, and secure the rabbit's foot. Is that right?
Let's be honest, Adam. It's a bit confusing sometimes.
It is, because I don't know, because I do know that they have Davian after the mission in the Vatican, and they have the rabbit's foot. But the way they go about the heist does not seem like the most efficient way to do that, because they split both of them up, don't they?
Yeah, like they kind of, it's like Damien's there with a briefcase.
His name's not Damien.
It doesn't matter. Philip Seymour Hoffman's there. Philip Seymour Hoffman is there with a briefcase, presumably to buy the rabbit's foot or to
sell
the rabbit's foot.
No, I think he has the rabbit's. Oh, someone's got the rabbit's foot. Who cares? Look, I think that
you're not watching the sequence going, where's the rabbit's foot? No one gives a fuck what or where or why the rabbit's foot is.
But Philip
Seymour Hoffman's the bad man who's going to shoot Tom Cruise's wife, and they need to get him.
Yes, and the big thing about this heist is Tom Cruise needs to disguise himself as Philip Seymour Hoffman, which leads to the absolutely excellent sequence where Philip Seymour Hoffman is playing Tom Cruise playing Philip Seymour Hoffman, and he's so good at it. I don't know what it is that he's actually doing, but I have no doubt in my mind that that's Tom Cruise inside Philip Seymour Hoffman's body. Yeah. It's like a really good imitation of Tom Cruise, even though he looks obviously nothing like Tom Cruise, but his body language and his movements and the way he delivers his lines is pure Tom Cruise, which is an incredible thing for Philip Seymour Hoffman to be doing. And it's really fun.
He's a good actor.
He's a great actor. I think he's honestly incredible, and he's one of the biggest losses to cinema. He's fantastic. Have you seen Synecdoche, New York?
No.
You must see Synecdoche, New York. It's absolutely a mesmerizing film. I tell you what, though, I will say that this is the worst heist in any of the Mission Impossible movies, because when Tom Cruise gets to the top of a wall and lies down, he says, "Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall."
I paused the movie. I didn't know how to process it.
What is that about?
I was so distracted. I missed the next bit where he does a costume change. I had to rewind and be like, I need to watch this properly, because
it's so shit.
And it's not. He doesn't just say it. He turns to the camera and says
he doesn't look at the camera, though. But
he doesn't look down the lens, but he rolls towards the camera and then says it just past the camera, to the point that he may as well be looking down the lens.
It's played in the same way as, I don't know, when Roger Moore there's a bit where he, as James Bond, throws someone out the window and they land in a truck that's full of pillows and all the feathers go poof like that. And Roger Moore goes, all those feathers and he still couldn't fly. And it's the same like energy, but in this case, it's Tom Cruise on top of a wall saying to nobody, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall.
Yeah. So we have to think that all the time when he's been doing any mission, including the two missions we've seen him do, just off camera, he's saying random things to himself. Based on fairy tales and nursery rhymes.
You think every time that he's been on top of a wall, he has said to himself, either in his head or out loud, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. And this is just first time cameras have picked it up.
Yeah, I think that in Mission Impossible 2, when he's hiding up in the pipes before he swings down and like kicks on in the head, he goes, yeah, don't hang around too long, Ethan. And then he does it. And he finishes talking just before the camera catches him.
Okay, yeah, I can see that. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's so weird.
The only thing I can think of is that it's a signal to the other members of the IMF team to say, I'm on top of the wall now.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel very Ethan. Ethan would usually just go, I'm there. Or like, I'm on top of the wall now. He might even just say that.
Yeah. I don't think he'd say anything. I think that's the easiest part of the plan is, can you get over the wall? Imagine if Ethan Hunt just went, guys, I know you've all done your bit, but I couldn't get over the wall. I
could not get over this fucking wall.
I should have gone in the sewer with the other guy. Like, what?
Was this on the blueprints? And why did no one tell me about this wall?
We opened with the wall, Ethan. You opened with the wall, saying it's a 30-foot wall.
Oh, ludicrous. I don't know why he says it. He does dress as a priest, though, which is a nice little nod to the fact that that Tom Cruise was going to become a priest at one point. And the heist goes off. He's good at it. He looks like a priest. The heist is pulled off. They have both the rabbit's foot and Davian. And Ethan starts to interrogate Davian on the flight home. They don't have the rabbit's foot, do they? No.
I think he was going to buy the rabbit's foot and then they get him and then go,
right, they don't
where's
have
the
rabbit's
foot
at all.
Which at that point is odd because you just go, why didn't you wait for them to complete the sale? And then
ten minutes of us talking, because about 10 minutes ago I said, oh, they're trying to get the rabbit's foot or whatever. People who've seen the movie recently will be screaming at this podcast going, no, that's not right. And we've just realised and they've just caught up. So apologies if you were very frustrated by us deviating onto the 30-foot wall chat because we were getting the plot wrong. But yes, they just have Davian, I think.
Adam, I can't now remember whether they want to get Damien or the rabbit's foot.
Davian!
I don't care! Damien sounds better. It makes him sound like a little devil child that grew up.
Yeah, all right, I'll allow it.
I don't know if they're after him or the rabbit's foot, because it seems like they're very much like, we've been tracking this guy for ages and we really want to like get him because he's like a big black market arms dealer. But equally, we also want a rabbit's foot.
Well, okay. So I think I can answer this question because broadly, the villain, the real villain, isn't Davian. It's Billy Crudup. It's Musgrave. The interim director of the, or whatever it is, you know, the middle management of the IMF. So he wants the rabbit's foot. That is the answer to that question, is he wants the rabbit foot. And I think Davian is kind of expendable to him, or he's working with Davian or whatever. It's very muddy, I think. But that's fine. It's fine. It's entertaining enough. But they do have Davian on the flight home and they're, you know, interrogating him. What is the rabbit's foot or whatever? And, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance there, he's very calm and collected. He's just saying, like, if you've got a wife, I'm going to find her, but I'm going to hurt her. Yeah. And then I'm going to kill you in front of her. And it kind of riles Ethan up. And he sort of, basically nearly throws him out of the plane. In a very intense interrogation sequence. That doesn't feel very Ethan Hunt to me.
No, I think having had his protege, her brain explode in front of him, and now with the threat of, I'm going to kill your wife, I think that's just him flipping out and realizing that there is too much emotional, he's too emotionally invested for the sort of work that he's in, which is probably why he got out of it in the first place.
Right, yeah.
Which we also see kind of play out with the rest of the films, because he's very much like, I can't be with my wife, she will die.
Yes, but then there's also that, you know, tension with Ilsa, played by Rebecca Ferguson, one of the best characters in the whole franchise, you know, and, you know, look, we don't need to talk about the other Mission Impossible movies. I could talk about the other Mission Impossibles all day. I'm really looking forward to getting to Fallout.
Yes.
Yeah, anyway. They then transport Davian across a very long bridge.
Impossibly long bridge.
I'd have flown him, probably. Yeah. I would not move
in a
convoy.
Plane.
Yeah, they had a plane. Maybe it's because they didn't have a helicopter pilot. They do have a helicopter pilot, though. I don't know why they're moving him this way. It's kind of a
He just doesn't fly a helicopter for the rest of the film.
He does. He flies it. Is he not flying it? No, he's not, is he?
No,
a helicopter pilot? Yeah, he is a helicopter pilot.
He's the guy who flies a helicopter through the wind turbines. But he.
So when Tom Cruise is swinging around, like, from building to building,
he's firing tennis balls.
Why don't they use a helicopter?
Because he needed to do a swing.
Okay, fine, whatever.
To be fair, I think the original plan for that bit is that he swings across without anyone noticing, hence the tennis ball, cricket ball, whatever, distraction, softball
right.
distraction. But then a few people do notice, and he just, you know, dispatches them accordingly.
Still seems like a helicopter would have been
It would easier. Have been easier, yeah.
Yeah. They are on this very long bridge, and they look on this laptop from that has the decoded micro dot from earlier on it, and turns out that Lindsay had discovered that Director Brassel is a mole inside the IMF leaking information to Davian, and that's Lawrence Fishburne's character. Oh my God, he's a mole. Now, I got confused, and I thought that they meant he was the small underground creature, a mole.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's a realistic-looking human suit. But I'm led to believe that that is a term that even we've used on the podcast before, from the first Mission Impossible, that there is, like, someone inside your organisation leaking information to the outside of the organisation. That's what a mole is.
Right.
Okay.
And not somebody just tunnelling into the IMF.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's not someone just
tunnelling. Their small little claws.
Yeah, their small little claws and their tiny little eyes. but then, suddenly, Ethan, played by Tom Cruise, and his team are attacked by, I don't know, mercenaries who are using this big drone, and they manage to steal Davian back. It's a good sequence. There's lots of running and jumping and explosions on the bridge. This is also, you know, the big... There were a lot of moments from this sequence in the trailer, I remember. I remember, obviously, when he's running away from a missile and it blows up, and then he flies sideways into a car. That's a big...
Absolute cruise
showpiece.
Points.
Yeah, huge cruise points.
Massive cruise points for that.
Even though, again, most of it is on a green screen.
Most of it's on a green screen, but there is a car there, and he was running past the car, and then wires flung him into the car.
Yeah, yeah.
So that essentially what we see on the screen did happen.
It's just the background.
It just wasn't. The explosion was added in. But the violent act that is put on Ethan Hunt was put on Tom Cruise.
Yeah, and it does genuinely make so much of a difference in films like this that you can see it is Tom Cruise. Like, you can see him acting, along with the thing that he's going through. And it's, it's a good action sequence, kind of a standard action sequence. It's fun. It's entertaining. And then, of course, Davian has escaped, and he knows Ethan's name because they let that slip.
Because Luther's just not good enough these days. He's not professional enough.
Although I have to say, knowing the twist and that there's a mole inside the IMF, probably would have been able to find out where his wife was anyway.
He'd just been like, hey, you know we're in very close business at the moment, and you sent IMF, and you're in charge of IMF. The guy who was leading the IMF team, what's his name?
Yeah, exactly.
Won't tell you.
I refuse. So Ethan immediately rushes to the hospital where Julia works, and he arrives. Doesn't he pass her?
Like, yes, she is
abducted
in...
and put into a body bag by an unknown sort of agent, and he runs past that gurney as he's running into the hospital. Very frustrating, very well done. Did enjoy that. And then, at that moment, when he's realised that Julia is not there and she's been abducted, Ethan receives a call from Davian with a proposition. He must retrieve the rabbit's foot from a facility in Shanghai within 48 hours or his wife will be killed. And Ethan wants to get that started immediately, but is surrounded by IMF agents because they think that, well, they want to take him in because this whole Vatican City mission was not approved. That was just sort of, he'd formed some kind of rogue nation under a ghost protocol, and he's now reaping the fallout of that decision.
Do you reckon he's dead?
Okay, yeah, that's good. But one. I do reckon he's dead. Part two.
I hope Cruz listens to this because I imagine
he definitely does. He's been listening since week one.
He's changed the. He's now changing Mission Impossible to be Mission Impossible 7. I reckon he's dead.
I reckon he's dead.
But one.
Yeah, that would be a good title. I like that. He is surrounded by the agents. He tries to escape. There's lots of Tom Cruise running. He is ultimately apprehended, though. However, he then manages to escape from them again with the help from Musgrave, who in the future we will learn is the actual villain. But that's very nice. Like all the stuff with Tom Cruise in like the Hannibal Lecter mask and doing the Captain America stuff, beating people up in a lift and escaping and putting We Are Family on the walkie-talkie and all of that stuff. It's all nice business. You know, it feels fun.
Yeah, it was fun. And I liked Lawrence Fishburne saying that he likes his sleep.
Yeah, of course. He's a grumpy man. He's a grumpy man.
I love my sleep.
And, of course, the lip reading comes back. You know, like, I actually didn't even remember the lip reading from the party. It was a setup for how he escapes from being tied up. So that was, you know, it's fairly neatly done.
You have to presume that everyone at IMF can do this. And therefore, Musgrave assumes that. Because otherwise... Musgrave would have to assume that a random thing that he did at a party in which he did not attend, despite not getting the invite, he's just sort of like, I'm going to use that trick.
Yeah, no, he knows his training. Yeah. He knows his training. And then we're in Shanghai. Ethan, played by Tom Cruise, reunites with his team once more. And the plan is to infiltrate this heavily guarded building, which contains the rabbit's foot, and steals it. Now, the thing about this heist is that most of it happens off-screen, except for the huge aerial acrobatic bit. Tom, explain the plan, because I couldn't make head nor tail of it.
Oh, God. Well, so Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and Maggie Q are going to shoot softballs onto the roof of a neighbouring skyscraper, because Tom Cruise is standing on the other one.
Right.
To distract the guards so that he can do a big jump off the side of the building, swing, and then drop onto the roof of the other skyscraper, presumably without being seen, hence the softballs, but he is seen, so he shoots the guards while sliding down. There must be an easier way to get into that building.
Yeah, probably. But, you know, as we set up in Mission Impossible 1 and 2, he just loves doing aerial acrobatic stuff.
Yeah.
The reason for doing it in this movie is less convincing than any of the other Mission Impossible movies, because he does more aerial acrobatic stuff in the fourth one, but this time on the side of the Burj Khalifa, the tallest building in the world.
For real.
Not
just green screen of like a three-story drop.
Just absolute madness. Absolute madness. But the reasoning behind this one feels less... I buy it less than the other ones, and... therefore, I think this is probably the weakest of them all.
I think there's an element that, like, because they have the whole mystery box thing of what is the rabbit's foot, doesn't really matter. It's a massive MacGuffin. They can't really do a inside the facility heist,
right,
because it would be a repeat of number two, because
mm-hmm.
it's just some sort of chemical compound from a lab, basically.
Yeah.
And there'd be no reason to be invested because there's no stakes.
Yeah, that's true.
So it basically just becomes set piece to get onto the building and then set piece to get away from it.
There's a car chase, isn't there? And, you know, trying to keep the thing that has the rabbit's foot in it and trying to make phone calls because he's very close to the deadline with Davian. And it's a good sequence. Not very artfully done, but very fun to watch. Yeah.
It's definitely an action sequence disguised as a heist, because there's no actual heist.
No, there isn't, no. But then we've had the heist with the Vatican City.
Yeah.
And that is fun, that bit. So I guess, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I do quite like having everybody outside waiting while the clock ticks down, and then having just crews explode through a window.
Yeah, it's not awful.
That's quite satisfying.
It's not awful. It's just the least interesting of the three aerial acrobatic things we've seen so far, I think. The most interesting, obviously, being the first one, with the room where he's got to be silent and he can't sweat. And then
you say the least. I would say number two, where they repeat number one but do it on green screen.
But I was more invested in that sequence than I am in this sequence, because Ethan's off screen for a lot of it, you know. Anyway, they get it, and then he goes to meet Davian, and he's like, well, you know, what's the plan here? And he's told not to ask any questions, and he's instead made to drink something which knocks him out, and he awakens in this sort of seedy room where he's injected with an explosive charge. So now Ethan has a tiny little bomb in his head that's going to blow up his brain. And then we're into the scene that we saw at the beginning of the movie, which is Julie... and Ethan. Now, I actually called her Julie and then paused and said, but I realised from my notes that her name is Julia, and so that makes sense, and I could just continue with what I was saying.
Yeah.
So, Julie...
Just clip out the slight pause.
Yeah, I might do.
Just edit it out, mate. It's fine.
They are tied up opposite each other with, you know, Davian counting down from 10, if he's not told the location of the rabbit's foot, he's going to shoot her in the head. And then Ethan is panicking, insists that he has delivered it because he reckons he has. And then after counting to 10, he shoots Julia in the head and then leaves. Davian just sort of leaves. And then Musgrave enters. He's the villain. He's the traitor. And explains. Okay, so I've got the plan written down here. Okay, you ready? You ready for this?
Yeah. Yeah.
He explains that Davian is going to sell the rabbit's foot to known Middle Eastern enemies of the United States, the resulting attack being anticipated and controlled to generate only acceptable losses, the concept of a false flag attack taken to the next level. This will then justify a massive retaliation that would result in an internationally supported hostile takeover of the region. That's interesting. And it's a shame that it takes exactly as much space in the movie as it took me to explain it. It's not woven into the theme of the movie.
And it happens so soon after something that's quite emotionally shocking for the character. It's quite easy to gloss over when it's happening.
I didn't know that that's what was going on until I read it, basically, after I'd seen the movie. Which is a shame because, you know, 2006, in the same way that last week Spielberg was using a lot of post 9/11 imagery in a post-9/11 world, to have the Mission Impossible franchise interacting with, you know, the war that was going on in the Middle East and the troubles in that region that were largely caused or exacerbated by America is actually interesting, but I do see why they kind of minimized its input into the plot. I suppose Mission Impossible kind of supposed to be a fun time, don't necessarily need to be reminded of all the atrocities going on in the world.
Imagine a Mission Impossible movie where it is Ethan Hunt going up against Islamic terrorists.
Right, yeah, that's not
that
much fun.
It'd be so bleak. It'd be horrible.
And it leans, you know, the future movies of the Mission Impossible franchise lean in. The thing that I like about them is they lean into the old Cold War threat. The kind of like Eastern European, where are our nuclear bombs sort of thing. I mean, the next one, the one that hasn't come out, is going to feature a submarine, which is pretty cool. Like, that's such like a
Has
relic
Tom
of the
Cruise
Cold War.
Has Tom Cruise got a license to pilot it yet?
Well, that was going to be the name of the movie. They were going to do like a ripoff of License to Kill. It was License to Pilot a Submarine. But they thought it wasn't that catchy.
No, which is a shame. I reckon, because I know that Tom Cruise has a list of different licenses to his name at this point. I wonder if he got his boating license for this, because there is a very brief shot where he's on a jet boat, whatever it's called.
Well, here's something fascinating. You don't need a boating license.
Oh.
I was in Scotland recently and I looked into briefly, like, what if I wanted to hire a boat? I imagine I need some kind of training. Nope. They'd have just given me a boat.
Yeah. I was going to say, also, I know quite a few people in America who just have boats and they don't have licenses. Exactly. So I don't know why.
Bizarre. It's because once you get out onto the water, it's a lawless territory.
Yeah. I think. It's maritime law, mate. It's maritime.
Exactly.
Do whatever you want.
Musgrave shows Ethan, played by Tom Cruise, that the dead Julia was actually one of Davian's incompetent personnel wearing a mask of Julia. I love all the mask stuff in the Mission Impossible movies.
I love that they describe as being incompetent because she couldn't see through a disguise by a professional who can disguise themselves as you.
I know. Yeah, it's really ruthless. But they were kind of doing that fake out of killing Julia to make sure that he had brought the real rabbit's foot. And Julia is, in fact, still alive and nearby. Ethan escapes. He bites Musgrave, which is quite cool. I like when people bite things. And then attacks him, takes his phone, which he then uses to track Julia's location with the help of Simon Pegg. And so much running in shoes. Oh, my God. Yeah. This is the birth of the Tom Cruise runs like a maniac thing, right?
Yes. It's that, insane.
That unbroken shot of him running through the Chinese streets is crazy. And Chris said last week, like, and it just keeps going. And it just keeps going. And it's one of the most impressive stunts that he's ever done, Chris reckons.
Yeah.
Which is great,
The whole time he looks like an Olympic sprinter. And he's going for, like, the best part of a minute.
Yeah. And you know they didn't do just one take, right?
Like,
there's got to be numerous takes of that. Crazy. Looks incredible. A very kinetic filmmaking going on at that point. And he does find Julia. But before he can free her, Davian activates the bomb in Ethan's head. And now there's this whole sort of, like, I could do without this. The absolute peak of this movie, action-wise, is Tom Cruise running. And all he needs to do is find Julia, shoot Davian in the head, and then it's done. But instead what we have is this whole thing where he has to go about trying to, like... He's got a huge headache, basically, and he needs to defeat Davian, teach Julia how to operate a gun, and then find a defrib. But there is no defrib, so he has to, like... MacGyver one out of some wires that he's pulled out of the wall and some kind of bowl, and he's like trusts her to bring him back from the dead or whatever. It's a bit similar to the Casino Royale scene where Bond has been poisoned and then has to sort of stop and restart his heart, and it's, you know, it's fine.
It's fine.
It's quite funny to see Philip Seymour Hoffman in a fist fight with Tom Cruise. That's quite funny.
The best part of that is the fact that Tom Cruise defeats him using just his elbows.
Oh, yes, of course, because he's got to hold his head, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Yes. And then ultimately defeats him with a truck.
By being fortunate enough to not be as high as the underbelly of a truck.
Yeah, real luck shit, which I quite liked. But then, he kills a bunch of people. He gets resuscitated, kills Musgrave. Julia kills Musgrave, right?
Yeah.
And then they walk out with the rabbit's foot, and Ethan comes clean and is like, hey, you know, I'm a spy. And then she makes fun of the fact that the place is called Impossible Mission Force. And, you know, she's not earned the right. She's not earned
And that's
the right.
why she's written out of all future movies.
Yeah, well, she's written into them.
Essentially. You're not going to be a main character going forward, I'm afraid. You've gone off script. You've made fun of the IMF.
And then there's that whole tacked on scene at the end where he's back at headquarters and he's being like patted on the back for his heroic actions.
This is Abrams being Spielberg again.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, because they leave for like a honeymoon.
Up happily ever after.
They leave for a honeymoon and then like, oh, it was like, oh, maybe you'll come back to you know, do another mission or whatever. He's like, oh, maybe I won't. And, you know, all of that stuff.
And everyone claps.
Everyone claps. And I
everyone
clapped.
Everyone claps.
I clapped. Yep. I stood in my lounge and clapped. Tom, did you?
Yeah.
Of course we did.
Yeah. And I saluted the screen for his service.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's the movie. What did you think of the movie, Tom?
I thought it's good. I didn't feel it's like with Mission Impossible 2. I didn't feel like the ending deserves the Mission Impossible theme to kick in.
Right.
You can't have him happily walking, end on a freeze frame of him smiling, and then go. It's no. That's not the impressive dramatic heist music. Like you can't use that for happily ever after. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, no, it's not happy ever after because he walked off all happy ever after with Naya and she's nowhere to be seen.
We also know it's not happy ever after because there's three more movies. Well, there's five more movies.
Yeah.
So unless the next five movies are just sort of like him sitting at home, hanging out with his wife, you know, it can't be that happy ever after, can it?
No. It's a good film, though. It is a good film. I enjoyed it. I had a great time watching it. But it, like you said, it's not really a masterful piece of art, is it?
No, it's also just not very, very memorable.
No, also. It's not very memorable because it's not very imaginative.
Yeah, which sounds like we're being really harsh. It's fun. It's entertaining. Yeah. I had a good time. It's all very shiny. J.J. Abrams is very predictably kind of all about the plotting and the sequences rather than actual emotional heft, but Tom Cruise is adding that in, you know, his take on Ethan Hunt here is a bit different from the previous ones, and I think it's actually really good. He plays him as a bit more vulnerable, and that's a good choice. It kind of adds actual stakes to the movie. And it's just kind of forgettable. It's like stuck between the stylistically focused first two and then the very confident subsequent ones. Just feels indistinct. It's very fluffy. And do you know what? I was on the fence between 3 stars and 3.5. Ultimately, it's one of those films that I have a really good time when I'm watching it. And then when I start thinking about it, bits of it start to crumble away or whatever. So, but I am going to give it 3.5. But it's kind of a weak 3.5. It's not like... If you look at other films that I gave a 3.5 to on this podcast, like I think The Firm is better than this. I think Rain Man is better than this. So it's kind of like a weak 3.5. But that's where I am. Where are you?
Yeah, I'm also giving it 3.5. I had a great time watching it. It's a very enjoyable, simple film, which I think to some extent is what it was designed to be. I don't think J.J. Abrams was trying to do anything more than just give people a good time.
Yeah, he loves to give people a good time. That's what I've heard about.
That's it.
He stands on street corners asking if people want to have a good time.
Yeah. That's how he got into the business. I do find the whole MacGuffin-y thing really annoying.
It's a bit tedious, isn't it? Yeah.
Because it's not just that it's a... Because pretty much every film, really. It's like it's a criticism that's often levied at... pretty much, you know, every film under the sun. But, it's just this time they had to get a MacGuffin. But it's like, well, that's how stories are made. Otherwise, you just have two characters sitting in a room talking. That would be it.
Are the kind of movies that I really like, Tom.
Sure. But I think if you're having like an action movie, you've got to, because otherwise it's, you know, it's just too... What, you could have one guy chasing another guy because he's going to hurt another guy or something.
Sure. Right? I mean, that confused me. That was too much plot for me, Tom. You've got one guy chasing another guy because he's going to hurt a third guy.
Well, the twist is the third guy is actually going to hurt the first guy. And it's
like
massive.
A big circle. Tom, we need to write this movie.
It's Mission Impossible 9.
Why has no one done that? Why has no one done a thing where person A is chasing person B and person B is chasing person C, but person C is chasing person A? Circle. We need to plot this out. The anonymous MacGuffin thing, I think it kind of goes back to what we were saying a little bit earlier about how we like watch movies and the kind of switch your brain off watching versus the intellectualization of all movies, right?
Yeah.
Whether warranted or not. The nameless MacGuffin thing, when I'm watching this movie, completely works. But then the person that I am, who's quite into filmmaking and the process of filmmaking and the art of filmmaking, then sits back and goes, why don't you just fucking write something? Yes. Instead of just leaving a big hole in your screenplay and hoping that people won't mind, just fucking write something with a bit of imagination behind it.
Yeah. No one minds.
Do you know what? One out of five.
Because no one minds in like a standard superhero movie if someone has to go and get something, because if they don't get something, the bad guy will get something. No one cares in Minority Report if you have like the Minority Report, because it all seeds into the like the overall theme and plot of the movie. Yeah. The real issue with this one is that they have a MacGuffin and they know it's a MacGuffin and they have to acknowledge it because they know they've done an unsatisfying job of explaining what the MacGuffin is.
Yeah, it's frustrating. But it's only frustrating if you're doing a film podcast where you talk about Tom Cruise. It's not that frustrating when you're watching the movie, you know?
No, it's fine. It's just, I think the fact that they had to have Tom Cruise going, so did we ever find out what the rabbit foot was? And Lawrence Fishburne going, ha, 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 don't worry about it.
Oh, do you know what? It's not actually, the way they justify it in the movie is not so bad. Doesn't he say, like, if you stay, I will tell you what it is?
Yes.
And then he makes the emotional choice to go, like, yeah, I don't want to know that badly. Which is kind of nice, actually.
It's fine. It's fine, but it's also them acknowledging that they've used a MacGuffin.
Yeah, they haven't written anything.
For the sake of creating a plot, and it has nothing to do with the story.
Yeah, absolutely. The Cruise-ness, I've gone quite high. Because of all that stuff that I was saying about how, like, this is a normal movie, and even the director wasn't really, like, thinking that hard about the emotional heft about it, so it relies on Tom Cruise to put it in there. That means that the fact that Tom Cruise is putting that in there and is bringing so much of what he's good at to the movie and exploring sort of darker areas of Ethan Hunt's character, but also there's the fucking run and the being pile-drived into a car. I think this movie is very Cruise. It's kind of the birth of what we know Cruise to be now. And I've gone 8 out of 10. The beginning of the Cruise I've got written next to it.
Nice. Yeah, I'm also going to give it an 8 out of 10, twinning. Because, yeah, I mean, obviously I don't judge it on his performance as such, as more of his dedication, I guess.
Yeah.
But I do think he's actually bringing in more of what makes Tom Cruise Tom Cruise than we saw in War of the Worlds, for example.
I agree. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's much more of an emotional performance, which, again, I care more about Ethan Hunt as a character in this film than I probably do in the two others.
Yes, and I think that is all down to Tom Cruise rather than the way that the film is made, to be honest.
Yeah. And for a Mission Impossible movie, there's still not that much stunt work. Like, I went searching afterwards to see what stunts are there in this film, and it really is just Tom Cruise ran a lot and he was flung into the side of a car.
And he sat on top of a wall as well.
Well, he sat on top of a wall, but don't worry, the wall was also constructed and partially green screen.
Okay, was it?
Okay, great. Yeah, they had to basically have him climb up a wall and then show the backdrop of one thing, and then there's a real-life wall on the other side and stuff. So it's not all...
Seamless.
Yeah, it's done very well, but yeah, it's fake.
Would you recommend this movie?
Yes.
I might.
We discussed if somebody was starting... the Mission Impossible films, we'd be like, maybe start with 3.
Yeah, this is actually the first one that I think is probably essential to a watch of the whole franchise, because it
sets up... You'd be very confused in 4 and 6 otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. It sets up the relationship between him and Julia and, you know, all of that stuff, doesn't it? So I guess it is kind of integral to the overarching ongoing plot of the franchise. But it's, you know, yeah, it's fine. It's good to fine. Yeah, sure. This is like if someone was saying, like, I want a really good Friday night movie, and I was thinking about watching War of the Worlds, you'd go, no, watch Mission Impossible 3.
Yes.
Right? This is the anti-War of the Worlds.
If anyone ever asked you, I'm thinking of watching Mission Impossible 3 tonight, should I? I just, you know, and they're just looking for, you know.
Yeah, you just go, yeah.
Evening. Sure. Yeah.
Have you seen it before? No, then yeah. If you've seen it before, don't bother. It's not really worth a rewatch, I don't think. No, it's certainly not worth the 4K copy I have of it now. Anyway, right.
No.
It's absolutely.
I've got it on Blu-ray. I'm glad I didn't have to rent it.
Tell you what, though, right? So it was quite positively received when it came out. It was more positively received than the first two across the board. It kind of holds like a 7 out of 10 on Rotten Tomatoes or whatever. People were praising Cruise's performance and the way that the film kind of holds together as a piece. You know, the plotting being very good, the pacing being very good. It feels just as of its time as the others, I think. But the response to it when it came out, it was really good. But there's sort of like, you know, I don't know, it was just sort of tinged by some stuff, really, because War of the Worlds came out close enough to all of the mad stuff we talked about last time. You know, all the stuff about, like, about drugs that people use to combat depression, yeah, and him jumping up and down on the sofa and picketing doctors, offices and stuff like that. War of the Worlds comes out close enough to all of that stuff that I don't think that its box office was really affected. Whereas, yeah, I think by the time Mission Impossible 3 came out, people were like, I'm not going to bother with Tom Cruise anymore. Including stuff like Tom Cruise wanted... There had been a recent episode of South Park called Trapped in the Closet that features a parody of Tom, yes, Cruise, right? And Tom Cruise said, if you ever air that again, like, because it was due to be aired around this time as part of its just like syndication run, he was just like, if I want that taken off the air, or I won't do any press for Mission Impossible 3 at all. And of course, Paramount, I think, own South Park, so they're in the, yes, position to make that call. So they do capitulate, which then led to a bunch of South Park fans boycotting this film. And I don't know if that necessarily hurt the box office performance of the film, but on a budget of $150 million, which is very high, it made, yeah, $400 million.
That's less than Mission Impossible...
It's less than Mission Impossible 2.
Two.
By about $100 million. And it's less than War of the Worlds by $200 million.
Yeah.
And of the two movies, Mission Impossible 3 and War of the Worlds, I know War of the Worlds is like, it's not an original IP, you know, it is an adaptation of a book, and yes, it's Spielberg or whatever, but you would think that the Mission Impossible 3 has more of brand recognition, bearing in mind how popular and successful the second one was. You'd expect this one to kind of double down on that.
Mission Impossible was still a very... Well, I mean, we know because we went and saw it, so we knew, yeah, about the series. It was a very popular brand.
Yeah.
War of the Worlds is... If Spielberg hadn't made that film, it wouldn't have done that well. Like, they made the, right, War of the Worlds TV series recently, and, like,
I've not
who's
seen it.
Watched it?
Yeah,
no, I don't know anyone who's seen it. I don't
know what it is. Hearing about it now for the first time.
Right. War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells is, like, a classic novel that,
yeah,
is the sort of thing that no one ever needed to make into a film, really.
Sure, yeah.
And Spielberg did a good job.
Yeah, because he updated it so successfully,
yeah,
I think.
And it's good because of the tone and the fact it's an analogy for a real-life thing.
Yeah, yeah.
If he'd just gone, oh, I'm going to do a War of the Worlds and I'll make it a Humans v. Aliens, it would be like Battlefield LA or whatever that film is.
Oh, God, yeah. I saw that. I went to see that in the cinema. Anyway, I think that $400 million, as big as that is, you know, is probably disappointing for Mission Impossible 3, and is another little thing that makes people think, ah, Tom Cruise is done. And it's kind of, I think, the slight disappointment of that and the negative stuff around Tom Cruise at this time is what then leads him to do Tropic Thunder, right? To try and reclaim, yeah, some kind of, like, cred by doing like something fun. It's why he does Night and Day, to like try and get back some of that cred by just doing something fun. And it's also probably is why, as we alluded to earlier, that the plans for the next step in the Mission Impossible franchise is that the fourth Mission Impossible movie will hand the reins from Ethan Hunt to a different agent. The plan is to maneuver Tom Cruise outside of the Mission Impossible franchise without causing too much damage to the franchise itself. No doubt also spurred on by the fact that towards the end of this year, in 2006, Paramount sever their relationship with Tom Cruise. After 15 years of working exclusively with his production company and numerous contract extensions on top of that, they say, no, we've had enough. And they cite the reasons as Tom Cruise's behaviour, the way that he is very controlling about his movies, the things that he says as part of the press tours for the movies has become too much for them now. And so they will no longer be working with Tom Cruise. MGM come to them, to Tom Cruise and Paula Wagner, who own Cruise Wagner Productions. They come to them with a deal that includes part ownership of the struggling United Artists production company. They used to do all the old James Bond movies and, you know, a bunch of stuff, yes. but they'd fallen upon hard times. And so I think Tom Cruise and Paula Wagner looked at it and thought, oh, we're going to be in charge of United Artists, which has kind of a legacy and a prestige behind it. And we're going to be in charge of reinvigorating that brand to a whole new audience in a whole new sort of time and film landscape, which is why it's absolutely demented that the film they chose to launch the United Artists brand with is Lions for Lambs. But anyway, like, we'll talk about that next week.
We'll cover that next week.
Absolutely bizarre. Before we wrap up, though, it's obviously time for our long-running game. Only one of us is allowed to look at the IMDb trivia page for each movie. This week it's Tom. He's going to present me with three pieces of trivia. Only one of them is one that he's made up. And I have to discern which one that is in two crews and a lie. Tom, it's a big week. I think, maybe.
I mean, every week's a big week.
Every week's a big week. What? How much money? We've been putting some money on this. How much money do I owe you currently?
Oh, it's approximately 320k.
It's much as that, is it? As much as that. So. It's £327,680. Double or nothing?
Yeah. Okay. I would have dropped the 7k, but I won't. I won't. I would have, but I won't.
I won't. Okay, fine. Okay, so double or nothing. I'm pretty confident this week because, you know, I had new tactics last week and sure, it didn't pay off last week, but I think I've got the measure of what it is right. that you're actually trying to do with these things, okay? You take a little thing, you change like a little bit of it or whatever, so, you know, it's fine. I reckon I've got this one. Tom, why don't you give us those three pieces of trivia?
Okay. Number one. When Tom Cruise first received the script, it was for a completely different action movie. Cruise was struggling to find the right tone for future Mission Impossible films following MI2, and upon reading it, immediately asked for it to be rewritten for the series.
That could be true. That could be true. It seems unlikely because Tom Cruise produced this movie, but you never know. You never know.
Well, I don't know. Maybe he got the script for a different movie and then went, oh, this would work really well for the movie I'm trying to produce.
So you think, you don't think Tom Cruise sat there and went, I need a, okay, maybe. All right. Look, okay, fine.
I reckon he sat there and went, I need a script. And then right. someone gave him a script for a different film and he went, do you know what? I reckon this would work.
Okay. Well,
with
all right.
some tweaks.
Let's see. Let's see. Yeah.
Well, let's see what you think about number two, then.
All right, all right.
After the success of Shaun of the Dead, Simon Pegg was asked if he was going to be pursuing a career in Hollywood, to which he laughed and replied, it's not like I'm going to be in Mission Impossible 3.
that's too much of a coincidence. I think you've just changed the name of the movie in the quote. There's no way. Okay, fine. Fine. Number three.
Tandaway Newton was offered the chance to reprise her role from Moana 2, okay. but turned it down to spend more time with her family.
And so you might have changed the reason that she turned it down. But no, I think that's true. I think I also read that because I brought it up earlier. So, yeah, sure. Okay, the least likely one is obviously that Simon Pegg mentions that he's not going to be in the movie that he ends up being in. So, Nice try, Tom. Nice try, mate. You've tried to like, oh, you've changed one little detail, and I know what you're about now. I'm going to smash this. I'm not just going to wipe the slate clean with this one, right? I'm going to end up in subsequent episodes making money, okay? Because we're going to keep putting money on this, all right? You pathetic little worm, okay? And I'm going to absolutely rake you over the coals, Tom, okay? Number two is the lie.
Adam. Number one was the lie.
Oh, fucking hell!
Oh! It wasn't even a convincing one.
That's devastating, Tom.
I wrote it this morning because I realised I'd just written down two truths.
Two truths.
I'll tell you a couple of other fun casting facts.
No, don't. I don't care. Yeah. I don't care.
Do you know
care.
Who was originally cast as Benji?
You.
Ricky Gervais.
Oh, fuck off.
Imagine if Ricky Gervais was in Dead Reckoning Part 1.
Fuck off. Oh, my God. That would have been absolutely awful.
And less awful would have been Scarlett Johansson as Agent Farris.
Yeah, that would have been fine. I'm just annoyed. Shouldn't have really said all
So how much
stuff.
Do you owe me now, Adam? It's 654,000.
£655,360. Fuck. Can we do double or nothing?
Yeah, you might make it back.
Take it up to over a mil. Just a smooth mil. Okay. I thought I had.
My life would be so easy from here on out.
Yeah.
Yours would be so hard.
Yeah, at the expense of my life. Well, anyway, that's how and why we play Two Crews and a Lie. Oh, Tom. There we go.
Adam.
We did it. We finally did it. Thanks, Tom. I don't know why I'm thanking you. Thank you, listeners.
I'm contractually obliged to be here.
Thank you to the listeners for joining us. Come and let us know what you think of Mission Impossible 3. You can let us know on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Cruise Views Pod. You can email us in something a little bit longer, and next week I'm going to have so much time to read some emails. Email us at cruiseviewspodcast@gmail.com. Come and find us on Letterboxd, Adam Glasspool, Tom Ashford. You get little sneak previews of what we think of each movie, even if it's just star ratings, and even if sometimes they change by the time we've reached the end of the episode we're doing about the movie. But while you're doing that, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to watch Lions for Lambs before next week's episode. The podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds.